Welcome to the Homer Chamber of Commerce's District 31 Candidate Forum. The participants are Representative Paul Seaton of Homer, Homer Mayor Beth Wythe, and John Cox of Anchor Point. The forum took place on Tuesday, August 9th at the Homer Elks Lodge and was moderated by Chris Story.
Okay, thank you for having me here tonight. Thank you, Karen, and thank you, the Homer Chamber of Commerce, and thank you, God, for this incredible weather. And so tonight we had three candidates, and so the coin toss wasn't going to work. So we went alphabetical. So we'll be starting with Mr. Cox here in a moment, and then moving to Mr. Seaton, and then Mrs. Wythe. And so I will just take a moment to say and reiterate what Karen said. Thank you all, because none of you are new to politics and or running or campaigning. Thank you for your service and taking time out of your lives to do this tonight. We're all win, lose, or draw indebted to your service and for taking your time to do this. So a big round just for you, Sean and Chris. Oh, Carrie Ann, so organized. Look at this. It's tabbed out everything. This is so cool. That's okay. It's just a reminder that if you do, see how subtle that was? If you do have a question, you would like to submit it, and you haven't had a chance to already, business-related questions, please put on a little note card, and that'll be read later if their time allows, but then you can hand that back to Carrie Ann or Adrian, and they might even wander around here during the question and answer. So just quickly, John Cox, Anchor Point, past president of the Anchor Point Chamber of Commerce, current businessman, has been competitive in the representative race against Congressman Don Young several times. You may have gotten to know him in that way, or his capacity as a business person here on the peninsula. Mayor Wyeth, of course, graduated in 1978 from Homer High. I think I went to that graduation with my mom. I think I threw a fit, and I apologize if I did. It's an age thing. That's not right. I was just a wee little lad at that time. And, of course, Beth Wyeth has been at Homer Electric for a very, very long time and very active in Homer city politics, and we thank you for your service there and being here tonight. Mr. Paul Seaton, first time I ever met Paul was back in 1988, I think, and my brother worked on his boat. He owned at the time then was at Georgia Straits, and known Paul and Tina ever since then, and big active part of our community as a business person, property owner, and obviously our representative. So thank you all very much. Another round of applause for our candidates. Moving right into the questions, which I actually thank you, Carrie Ann, for providing me the list, but I blew it up just a little bit because I refuse to wear the glasses. Tiffany, my wife Tiffany, says that one of these days I'm going to have to, but for now I'm getting away with it simply by modifying larger prints. So we'll be starting again alphabetically with Mr. Cox. He's got the microphone ready to go. Mr. Cox, are you...
Introductions.
So eager to get to the questions. Thank you very much. So we will now go to the microphone, if that's okay with everybody. John, take it away. 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chris. First, I want to thank my Heavenly Father for allowing life to run through my body. My wife, Susan, and my support team, Susan. the Chamber for getting this together, the Elks Club for putting it all together, allowing us to use the facilities, and all of you. I really do bless. It's a blessing to have all of you here to listen to what we have to say. My name is John Cox. My nickname is Bear, so if you see the signs, you'll see that's Bear on there. I have been endorsed by the Alaskan Right to Life, the Republican Assembly, and Joe Miller. I came to Alaska in the early 70s as a result of my father, who was in the Army. I graduated out of Bartlett and joined the Navy right afterwards. So that's how I got my nickname, Bear. When I joined the Navy, they found out I was from Alaska, and they started calling me Polar Bear. They thought everybody had a polar bear for a pet, you know. So after time, the polar dropped, and they just started calling me Bear. So please, I'd be honored if you call me Bear. After graduation, I served 30 years in the Navy. When I was in the Navy, I was a SEER instructor. I taught survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. Anybody subject to high risk of capture, I taught them how to live in a world where rules no longer apply. I also taught DESC, which is a desert evasion survival training, and PEDOS, which is a peacetime tension hostage situation. other valuable tools that the military gave me was they sent me to school to be a fiscal or a financial specialist. And I think that's something we need down in Juneau right now to help them with this debacle of a financial problem that we have. I am married. I got 3 kids, 2 granddaughters. I attended Southwestern, Excelsior, MB Riddle Aeronautical, Navy College, and Harvard. I served as chairman of the Friends of the NRA for a couple years, president of the Chamber of Commerce in Anchor Point, member of the VFW, and I'm now a member of the Masonic Lodge. Tom. I served as a range master over the Kachemak Gun Club. I provided women on target shooting practices. I taught them that. And I also taught martial arts to children with learning disabilities. And I currently own 2 businesses in Anchor Point. So, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Bear. Work that right in there. Mrs. Hitchens.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed being your representative in Juneau since 2003. I wanted to introduce my wife, Tina, although she probably doesn't need much introduction because most people knew me as the husband of Tina for her actions in Girl Scouts and all. So anyway, she's here with me, as she always is, in Juneau as well. That's what makes it so that it's tolerable. As you can imagine, people running back and forth to home is very difficult. I came to Alaska in college days. I partnered in a tree clearing business out of Anchorage, and then I completed my degree in Fairbanks and got a teaching degree up there as well. I became manager of the muskox farm there, and which led through an interesting route to a boat and salmon fishing in Cook Inlet. I just decided I needed a bigger boat to fish halibut, and Tina and I went to the East Coast, and we bought a 47-foot shrimp boat and brought it through the Panama Canal and up the West Coast. And we used that to tender salmon in Cook Inlet here, and started a small processing business with herring on the west side of Cook Inlet. I became an importer of Swedish electronic jigging machines and then sold them throughout Alaska. And our marriage has survived 2 kids, building 6 boats, 3 houses, 2 shops, and remodeling various apartments. So why is this important to you? It's important to you because throughout all these experiences, I've developed a problem solving as a core attribute of myself. And so I deal with the same problems as you do, that is regulations, some of which make no sense at all, and employees, personnel. And in my business, I needed independent judgment. And so instead of treating everybody as employees under a line of command, I needed to have people that developed the skills to make decisions on their own. Because I'd have a captain that's in Southeast or out in Bristol Bay, there would be problems come up. They needed to know how to handle those. And so that's what I've encouraged throughout my time, is working together. And that's what served me so well in Juneau, is the ability to work together. It doesn't matter, it's cross the aisle. It's working on Alaskans' problems, not particular party problems. But the problems that we have are for all Alaskans, and I treat all ideas the same. We need to look at them, see what works, what doesn't, and modify those things that have problems so that they become solutions. And I'm known as the driver for solutions. I introduce bills to get the discussion going long before they're needed. A short subject and title list shows the diversity of things I deal with. This is just from the last legislature: aquatic invasive species bill, wellness committee, benefits corporations, marijuana concentrates, state income tax, separate accounting for oil company corporate income tax, education and labor longitudinal database sharing, Medicaid reform, medical licensure compact, municipal property tax exemption, opioid prescription drugs, and a fiscal plan that combines the income tax, the PFD as a credit against that tax, and the permanent funds structural draw. So consistent with my work, I distribute this multi-use screwdriver to keep a driver in Juneau, and that's me, so reelect Paul Seaton. And I look forward to tonight's discussion. As we end the time, there's charts in the back of the room that'll show you the fiscal plan that I have proposed that is actually workable and gets there with one vote instead of the current situation where it takes about 12 different bills to get a plan accomplished. So you might take a look at those charts and see how that is structured. And it's also on my website, which you can get all of this information at, which is votepaulseaton.com. And I appreciate you investigating and giving any calls for any explanations you wish. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Paul. And we turn it over to Beth. Take it away.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear okay? This is always a challenge for me. I have a very small voice. I just first would like to thank everybody for coming. I appreciate you taking time out of your evening to come in and listen to us speak, learn more about us. For me, these forums are as much about answering your questions that you've submitted as they are about helping you kind of understand who we are as individuals so you could understand what you would expect from our personalities and our persons when we go to Juneau, how our representation would look for you. For me, that should never be a surprise. You should always be able to count on your representative responding in the manner that you're anticipating. Also, I would like to thank you for letting me, those of you that are from Homer, thank you for letting me represent you for the last 12 years in the local level, 8 years on the city council, 4 years as the mayor. It has been a pleasure, and during that time, I've been very instrumental with the financial stability of the city of Homer. We are in a unique position in Homer as we go into state reductions. We quit using state revenue sharing. The first time they didn't provide revenue sharing, I was on the council for 1 year and I said, how can you budget with money that you do not know you're going to get? And so from that platform, we have been able to create reserves that leave the city right now in a position of being able to bridge gaps that are being created, though they do need to create revenue to replace the revenue that was coming in from the state. So that's a challenge that we've been working through for over a year. I think that financial integrity is the primary function of government. I think their job is making sure that those services that private industry, private enterprise cannot or will not provide, that the citizens want to have, are provided. For me, those primary functions are public safety, harbors, roads, schools, and those are really core services, road maintenance and construction. And when you get all of those paid for, then you have money to look at other services that you can provide. Over the years, the state of Alaska has acquired many responsibilities from the federal government, and some of them I think should have been declined. We should have said, we don't have the ability to take that on. We shouldn't try to then figure out how to create budget after we've created the program. I think programs should be put in place with benchmarks so that when you get into, legislation isn't supposed to bind future legislators. So put a program into place that has a two-year benchmark so that the new group coming in can look at that program and say, is it really achieving the objective that we are paying for? If it's not achieving the objective, we need to either tune it in so it is, or we need to eliminate the program. I think the financial issue before the state of Alaska right now today is focused on those things that we have put into place so many programs and upgraded programs that we didn't take the forethought of. Oil and gas prices are not always going to be increasing. They're not always going to be production at the same level. You know, going into producing oil and gas, there's a finite amount out there in the ground. You can't pretend like it's always going to be available. So having some rollbacks built into the kind of government that we can provide, I think it was a piece that was missing. I come into this candidacy armed not only with my public service to the city of Homer, 12 years of government public service, but also with education. I went back to school a few years ago, completed my master's degree in public administration with a focus not of being a career politician, but of being able to represent people and really understand why the system isn't working. If you don't know what happens after you create a bill, you don't know how to create the bill so that it's implemented as you intended it to be implemented. And so I felt like that was a very important aspect of considering this run for this position. And so again, I just want to thank you for coming out. I appreciate your time. It is as valuable as ours, and we appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Either of you, Paul or Beth, have a nickname that we should use here tonight? I don't want to show
Beth
a favor.
Is it.
Beth, Paul, fair. Okay. Paul, since you've got the microphone, let's start with you. Unless I'm missing something, let me see here. No, we are. Wow, we are tracking really well too. As you can see, Tom Shrews is very on top of that, so we are just right on track. Good job, you guys. All right, the first question, and again, if you think of any based on the testimony you just heard before you're here today, Your Honor, or if you think of something while we're asking questions here, please be sure to add it to the back of the room and we'll get it during the Q&A from the audience section. Okay, Paul, we've got you on the mic at the moment. How do you propose reducing the cost of government and increasing and or increasing non-tax revenues? Is there a way to do both?
Would you repeat that?
How do you propose reducing the cost of government and how does increasing non-tax revenues to the state of Alaska?
Well, the biggest thing about increasing non-tax revenues is getting rid of or drastically reducing the oil tax credit system, which is a payment system in which we are paying out money to the oil companies based on their investment. We pay on the North Slope 35% of all the money that is invested. You as residents in this state pay the oil companies because until they're producing over 50,000 barrels a day, which only four companies do, all of the others, their expenses creates a net operating loss that creates a credit at 35%. That was part of SB 21, which I opposed and tried to get amendments on. And so that was the biggest portion of non-tax revenue, because that's a credit we give them, not a tax. And that's the largest portion that would be reduced. One of the things that's come up is the idea of limiting the amount of exposure. We have a limited exposure. The plan was built that says that if the price of oil is under $30 a barrel, 15% of the tax that we receive in production tax goes into a separate fund, and that pays these credits. Well, that was only $30 million this last year. What the legislature did was they put another $430 million into that fund to pay credits that wasn't actually due. And so I encouraged the governor vetoed that $430 million, that money that didn't have to be paid out. It's still an obligation, but it's like prepaying your mortgage or prepaying your pickup truck payment when you don't have the revenue. You don't do those kinds of things. And so I was very pleased that the governor reduced that amount of money that was there. And so that's still there for you next year. And so we're going to have to look at revenues. Almost all businesses that we want to stimulate are a cost to us because you try to provide an incentive. You have to do infrastructure, all of those things of which... So it's very difficult to stimulate revenue. I mean, we tried it with grain terminals. We tried it with a fish plant. We tried, rocket launch facility in Kodiak. So we tried a number of things. They generally don't work out when government does it. It needs the private sector making the decision that something is economic for them and that they go forward and do it. So we can aid, but we can't finance. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. John, same question. How would you propose reducing the cost of government and or increasing non-tax revenues?
Okay. The first thing you're going to learn is that I don't need all 3 minutes to make my point, right? The oil that's here in the ground of Alaska belongs to us, to you. And oil companies that come here to drill, we should not be financing them at all. If they want to drill, let them come and drill. If they do not, and they want to try and strong arm the state of Alaska into funding them, then my opinion is we tell them to pack their toys up and go away. Somebody else will come in here and drill for us so that we get our fair share of the revenue. Now, to make the government smaller, there are a lot of things we can do. For example, I propose that we have so many school districts throughout the state. Why don't we combine them? You're going to find that throughout the state where we do a lot of repetitive business. Why have one district doing the same thing as another district? Let's just combine stuff here. Let's make government small. Because when the government gets involved, the government does not create anything except dependence. They fail at the business side of the world.
Thank you, John. You did not need the 3 minutes.
No.
Beth, same question, I'll repeat it. How do you propose reducing cost of government and increasing non-tax revenues?
I think that there are some good points on the table right now. For me, going back and looking at oil and gas credits, I think the credit system is not viable the way it has been established. It doesn't, if it were set up so that it was generating appropriate production and limiting the amount of money that was paid out based on the amount that was produced, that you have a better opportunity, because if the oil is not produced, you have no revenue. It has to be sold for there to create revenue that is taxable. So I think that needs to be looked at, the oil tax credits. I don't believe just eliminating them is the right resolution. The value of employees working in the oil and gas industry, particularly in our district, is huge. And it's not just about, I know that it was cited earlier that you could pay them each $400,000 or pay $400,000 per person and you would still be ahead. But the contribution that they make into the economy with the multiplier effect is substantial. Not to mention, if they are not here participating at the local level in our economy, then the burden at the local level for the economy becomes kind of an unbearable amount at some point in time. You need to have people in the working class contributing to the expense of maintaining the economy in order for that to continue to be viable. So I think we need to really focus on industry that is maintaining jobs. And as I said at the library, I think we all receive our permanent fund because oil and gas is producing. If they're not producing, no money's going into that fund. There is no revenue other than earnings on the permanent fund, which is a finite amount of money as well. So I think we need to focus on the reality of continuing to maintain industry that we have while looking for additional industry opportunities. I see those industry opportunities coming through the marine trades. I see them coming through being able to access a portion of the services that will be required for those people using the Arctic Northern Passage to do transport. But they do require some investment in communities, harbors, and those sort of services to create a facility for them to come to. So nothing is without some kind of a contribution, but we have contributed a lot of money into things that no fruition has come out of, that we don't have the ability to drive to fruition. So we need to be looking at areas where we can create that income stream for the state.
Okay, thank you very much, Beth. If you'd hand it all the way back down to John, we'll start all over again.
Okay.
I'd like to recognize Casey Marsh, who's here with KBBI, doing a very good job, and then Michael, look at him working like a dog over there. Anybody thinking about getting into the press business, I think Casey's got the easier job recording than Michael writing. Okay, as I look across the vast audience, and thank you all for being here tonight, I do see that this next question will be pertinent to quite a few of you. No offense. First of all, John, are you in favor of the state continuing to offer the current property tax exemption for senior citizens? Why or why not? John?
Well, a bunch of 32-year-olds out there.
They got that to look forward to.
I'm in favor of the state continuing to giving the tax exemption to the seniors. The seniors are the foundation of this state. They were the building block of Alaska. Now, for the state to implement a 15% tax or take away the seniors' tax exemption, it just shows a lack of the state's foresight, the legislators' foresight in handling the fiscal problem. We have to look at all other aspects before we try and penalize our seniors. You know, as I traveled along the state, I met a lot of individuals, and they require and they need that permanent, the PDF, or their tax exemption, excuse me, to help pay for their property taxes, to help pay for oil during the winter seasons. They're on a fixed income, and so we need to protect these seniors. Let's not penalize them because of a lack of foresight of Juneau.
Thank you, John. Paul, same question. Are you in favor of the state continuing to offer the current property tax exemption for senior citizens? Why or why not?
Well, first of all, we don't offer a tax exemption because there is no tax that comes to the state. There's no sales tax, there's no income tax, there's no property tax. What we have is a mandate that local governments give a exemption. Quite different. When that was first done in, I think it was 1972, it was unlimited amount of exemption. And to qualify, you had to have an income of under $10,000 per year. It was then fairly rapidly, you know how things develop and get added on, it got changed to, it was instead, the exemption, the $10,000 needs base went away. So it was every senior got the exemption. And then in about 1986, I believe it was, we were, of course, the legislature at the time they passed that promised the municipalities that they would contribute that amount back to the municipalities. So whatever they lost in revenue, the state paid, and it did pay. And then in 86, it started paying less portion. And I think it was about, in the 90s, I wasn't in there. They said, we're not going to pay any, but you still have to give the exemption. So it's an unfunded mandate on local governments, and it doesn't have a needs base at all. So the question is not, should we have a exemption, but is, should the state mandate an unfunded mandate that impacts the local government's ability? I received resolution from the city of Homer that asked for us to consider removing the mandatory. It wouldn't get rid of it, but would have let them go back to doing a needs-based portion of that, because we have some very wealthy seniors, very high-income seniors, and that exemption there, somebody else has to make it up. If it was needs-based on income-based, most seniors here would probably get it, but not everyone. But I'm not making that decision. All the decision was to let local governments and local people decide what was appropriate for their locality, because it's a local property tax. It's not a exemption, it's an unfunded mandate that the municipalities have the exemption. And so that's still for the people to decide, and I'm sure we'll decide going forward. That bill was introduced. We didn't move it out of committee. It was in a committee I vice chair, but we got the discussion looking at the issue.
Good. Thank you very much, Paul. And to you, Beth, you want me to read the question?
I think I got it. Thanks.
Okay.
So I am in favor of the state returning the control of the question to the local government. As Paul said, at this point, it is an unfunded mandate. That does not mean that it can come back to the local government and the local government can say, oh, we're going to start collecting tax from you. The way the language is established, it would be a vote of the people that would return it to a taxable status. So what it does, and the reason the city of Homer requested it, was a conversation we've had with our residents where they ask us to figure out ways to increase our revenue so that we can keep all of the services that we're currently providing, because currently we cannot do that. So that was the reason we put it forward. But as more services are being pushed back to the local government, we've seen reductions in Homer recently, $400,000 out of our jails fund, but we are still required to provide jail services. So we need to have, the community needs to have control of every access point that they have for revenue. Thank you. And so things that you need to think about when you think about property tax. Property taxes also are attached to service area expenses, such as the hospital here. And so if you aren't contributing to a property tax, you're not contributing to the service area expense of maintaining the hospital, which would be the reason the Kenai Peninsula Borough is always down here knocking on our door trying to get us into a different service area setup. So we want to make sure that we keep the services that we want to have, and at some point we have to have the discussion of how we pay for that. In the 2010 December copy of the Economic Trends, they provided some information about kind of the working age group of employees or group of people in Alaska compared to those 65 and over between 2009 and 2034, which may seem like a long time off, but as time flies, it's really not that far. They projected that the working class in Alaska will increase by 11%, but the retired group will increase, will double. So if you think of those numbers, and you say the only people contributing into the property tax pie are this now minority of people that are working or they're in the working class, it makes you have to look at the question in the bigger picture. And that doesn't mean senior citizens are a burden. That doesn't mean anything. That means the question needs to come back to you. Do you want the services that are provided by those taxes enough to be a contributor to those taxes? And I am well known for saying, we are happy to provide the government that finances will pay for, and that question will be coming to you at the local level, and you will be engaged in that conversation. And so I recommend also at your city level, be engaged with the city of Homer as they continue that conversation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Beth. Mm-hmm. And you will just keep the microphone, and we'll just keep it rolling here. What role do you see the state of Alaska playing in controlling the cost of healthcare, either in business or for individuals?
Healthcare is a crazy thing right now. I work, part of my job, I'm in human resource management. A huge part of my job is looking at healthcare on an annual basis for four different groups of employees. I think that the communities, citizens, have the best ability to influence healthcare costs of anyone if you would start shopping your healthcare services. If we shopped healthcare the way we shop for a new pair of shoes or a new pair of set of tires for our car, we're looking for a similar or the same quality at a better price, healthcare costs would be forced to look at that in the industry. If they have no requirement, or if we're not requiring them to be competitive, there is no incentive for them to be competitive. I don't think it's something that the state or the federal government is going to be able to regulate. When insurance came into place was the beginning of the escalating healthcare cost, because there are actually healthcare providers that will bill your insurance, and you will never potentially know unless you're really in tune to your healthcare bills. You will never know what that cost of that service was. You may know what you paid for that service, but the cost of it may be 10, 20, 30 times what you paid for it. So become really good consumers. In the healthcare industry, that is your best defense, is to just become a really good consumer. When you get a bill, our insurance company has a 10% premium penalty or benefit. If you review your bill and you find an error on there and you save them money, they're going to give you 10% of what they saved. So be a good consumer. That's your best defense in the healthcare industry right now.
Okay, thank you very much, Beth. Paul, to you, does the state play a role in controlling healthcare costs for the businesses?
Yes, the state does play a role. In fact, we passed SB 74 this last year, which puts out care coordination systems, because what we're trying to do is mandate and have drive the appropriate care to primary care instead of emergency room services. There's no more expensive care than emergency room services, but anybody going into the hospital gets that care. The other thing is that we've got a global payment model that's in the SB 74, and the Kenai Central Peninsula had put in a model there, and so I think that'll go forward, in which case, instead of getting fee for service, in other words, every time you order a test, they get the hospital or the doctor gets paid, you get paid for keeping people healthy. You get paid per person based on the last year's average health care cost of the population you're serving. So that will probably give a stimulation, an actual stimulation, not an artificial one, for looking at both Central Penn and South Peninsula hospitals to work together and coordinate, because it's hard if you have one area getting paid per customer per year and the other getting paid on fee for service. So that may be some actual way that works. Also, of course, you know that I've been working for several years on vitamin D and healthcare here. We've now got the latest study that just came out with over 7,000 women over 55 that have gotten their vitamin D levels up above 50, and 65% reduction in all new cancers in that group. So we have the ability to influence the healthcare by influencing the health status of people. We also have the same thing with vitamin D on a big study that was made on adolescents. There was twice as much worry and anger and depression in those that had low vitamin D. If we're looking at adolescents and looking at the problems that we have, we need to get rid of some of the underlying medical deficiencies that are there, and you know, it's really cheap to do. Also, we've got the military coming out with the nutritional armor for the war fighter, and looking at omega-3s instead of omega-6 in our diet, and having a great impact of 50% reduction in stress fractures and depression and suicide. So we can influence our health, and that influence the healthcare cost.
That was pretty impressive, Paul. Don't be upset with me, okay? I'm a businessman. Now, anytime the government gets involved in the healthcare system, you see the prices skyrocket. They will mess up everything that we get involved with. Now, as a businessman, what is healthcare? Healthcare is a tool for me to attract quality employees. That is what it's for. I should not, and any business should not be required by the federal government or state involvement, that I have to provide health care to my employees. Now, my plan is, if with the state, we offer a health care savings program, just as you hear in the other people talking about. So they provide, for every $2 that they put into a health care savings system, the state will deposit a dollar as well. And this is what, you with those signs, I'm telling you. So that's what we need to do to help lower the cost of medicine here in the state of Alaska and throughout the United States. Let's get the government out of our pockets and let us operate as we need.
Okay, thank you, John. You have two more minutes. You've got, the sign lady would have given you more time. John might be able to keep the microphone there. We'll give you an opportunity to weigh in on this next one, and then we've got a few more questions, and then we'll be turning to the audience questions. So if something is ruminating, now's the time to get that to the back of the room. John?
Yes?
So many questions, so little time. What steps, if any, should the state take to diversify revenue and reduce its reliance on oil?
Okay, I've looked at this one pretty in depth. What the state has to operate now, they have to operate like a business, okay? So one suggestion would be to take and or borrow from the permanent fund a small portion of money. And then what they have to do is take that money and diversify it. So they need to take any type of income that we get, take a small portion that we can afford, and invest it in a high yield, high risk market. Then take another percentage of that and invest it in a medium risk, medium yield market. Then the following part, you invest it in a low risk, low yield market, meaning your state bonds and that type of item. Then once the revenue is starting to turn over and over, you take the initial amount of money that we borrowed from the state, from the permanent fund, and put it back in there. And until we can start developing a large revenue, then we can afford to help pay for some of these programs that we need to see throughout the state.
Okay, thank you very much, John. Paul, question is, what steps should the state take to reduce its reliance on oil revenue?
Well, we're going to have to become like all of the other 49 states and look at diversifying our revenue. They do it in three ways. They do it with property, state property tax, or they do it with a state sales tax, or they do it with a state income tax. Alaska is the only state that has a single source of 90% of our revenue, which is oil. It doesn't work. We've known that there's problems with this. We've been through cycles. This cycle is different because the technology for extracting oil out of shale and other developments around the world have meant that unless there is something really catastrophic, we are looking at $40 to $60 fluctuating oil prices in that range for at least a decade and a half. So we are in a situation where oil can't do it. We have the model from 41 other states have a income tax. I think it's 30, some have a sales tax, some of the in addition, some of them separate. And a statewide property tax just wouldn't work up here because we would have to assess all the lands around and then try to do that, and there's no state assessment for individual lands and all. So the question is, what kind of revenue source are we going to get? We've tried, like I said before, from rocket launch facilities to grain terminals and other things to try to force a revenue. We've tried timber, and it costs more for the roads than we got off of the timber. So there are no magic bullets that we have found, or really that any other states have found, other than saying, what are our revenue sources? Are the people of the state that contribute something to the services they get? And so I have proposed, and it's on the back there, you know, reducing the permanent fund dividend and marrying that to a state income tax of 15% of your federal tax, not a 15% tax, but your federal income tax multiplied by 15% of that, and that would generate $655 million. And the big thing is that it's sustainable. I mean, the graphs are back there. You can look at them. You can see what's working. And you can do it all in one vote. So that's, I think, the way that we can get there. No one else has proposed a solution without having at least a dozen votes. And every one of those votes, whether it's a penny for fuel tax, is just as hard as any other vote. So we need to do it simply and effectively. And I believe that that's the plan that I would propose. And I did propose. And I would support us looking at it. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Beth, same question to you, diversification and removing ourselves from the reliance on oil revenue.
And I think that the state has to look at every opportunity for diversification. To me, Alaska survived before oil and gas, and they worked hard, and they figured out how to make ends meet, and they worked together in communities, and everybody was pulling on the same rope, as the governor tries to say. But I think that a part that frequently is missing when we're looking at current day economy, going back to that same information that I was talking about with senior citizens, there is a very small portion of the entire very small population of the state of Alaska that contributes to the tax infrastructure by working. And so to take that same, if you look at the federal is a graduated tax, which would mean that the state would be graduated. Everybody would pay 15%, but you would be paying 15% of somewhere between zero and $60,000 or $70,000 or $100,000, depending on your income situation. And inevitably, all of these taxes, property taxes, they're coming on the same group of people. They're coming on your wage earners, generally the few people that are higher wage earners in your community. And so you can't look at them and say they're proportional or they're appropriate. We may end up getting to an income tax, but I think that we need to arrive at a place where the citizens of the state of Alaska want the services enough that they are willing to say, reduce our permanent fund, put an income tax into place. Sales tax, I think, needs to be left to localities and boroughs. It is the only source of revenue besides property taxation that they have to provide the many services provided on a local basis. I think the state has a lot of land. The federal government has a lot of land that for years has supposed to have been returned back to the state of Alaska. Those lands that are set aside need to be looked at and put up for sale In the beginning, Alaska had the Homesteading Act. Having the Homesteading Act did two things. It brought industry into the state of Alaska. It brought people. And of all of the things that we could benefit the most right now is a way to increase the population in the state of Alaska in kind of a short order. And so because the more people you have, the more you have contributing to the tax base, the more viable it is at a local level, at the state level, to provide services. So I think that we need to start looking at a bigger picture than just kind of the traditional, these are the things that we have in place. We need to look at taxation and at income in a different way than first jumping to taxation. Taxation is traditional, it's easy, it's all of those things. But I don't think that's where Alaska is. I hear some people that are there, but the majority of the people that I hear talking are not really interested in giving that up.
All right, thank you, Beth. Appreciate it. And so the first hour of the debate is going to look a little different than the second and third. Is everybody comfortable? I'm kidding. There's not 3 hours. We're right on track. And so what I'm going to do is I've called just a few questions that happen to sort of overlap some of the questions that were provided by the chamber and the membership of the Chamber of Commerce. And so, Beth, while you've got the microphone there, let's just continue on. And I think this one was asked several times, alluded to by the audience, and also the Chamber Board wanted to know, what as a representative would you do to attract new business to the Southern Kenai Peninsula?
Oh, and that was on your list of questions. You know, I have been, for lack of a better term, selling the Kenai Peninsula for 25 years. What I do in human resources, I interview hundreds of people a year for positions on the Kenai Peninsula. So I am really good at that. In a legislative capacity, you have a number of opportunities to showcase the area where you live. So my goal would be to become even more well-versed in the facilities, services that are available here, the types of business that exist right now, and figure out how to showcase those and sell those. For the City of Homer for 4 years, I have promoted City of Homer, Port and Harbor, and Marine Trades on a state level by going to the industry forum. The first year I was the mayor, they were in Homer, and I said to them, Homer is open for business. We are here to provide support services. We are here to provide Port and Harbor. And they really listened to that and came into Homer, and we have seen those industries boom in the last 4 years. So I think I have that ability as a 43-year resident in the Kenai Peninsula and Homer, I'm really familiar with, you know, we are a quality of life location, and we need to be promoting ourselves as a quality of life location. There are industries that are compatible with our environmental sensitivities that can come into Homer, and they can produce here, and they can sell here, and they can create commerce in this district. And so I would really love the opportunity to be able to represent you in that capacity here.
Thank you, Beth. Paul, what would you do to attract, you might want to add, what have you done, maybe answer a couple of different ways to attract business to the South Peninsula?
Sure, a couple of things are mariculture and going on across the bay. I was a big proponent of that, the geoduck clam industry that's starting. I passed the bill to allow that. However, what I'm looking at doing is trying to maintain what we have, because with the proposals that my opponents have both made, and that is waiting on taxation or no taxation at all, what we're looking at is departments going away. The first department that's going to go away, in my view, is going to be commerce, community, and economic development. That's not a core function of state government. When we are only getting 30% of the revenue to fund our budget, and the other 70% is coming out of your savings account, which will run dry in 3 years, then what the only way you can get there is start doing what some people want to do, and that's cutting government drastically. So as soon as you get to the point where you are losing the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, that means revenue sharing is going away. As soon as you get to the point where you're saying, well, let's take some of the pots of money and take the Alaska Performance Scholarship and try, that goes away. As soon as you get to DEC and say, well, you know, we really don't need those food inspectors. We'll go back to regulation by litigation. And that's where we'll go. Workers' compensation is a business-friendly, it doesn't seem business-friendly, but it's an insurance so that you're not in lawsuit all the time. That's going to go away because that's not a core function of state government. If the proposals of my both of my opponents go forward and we do nothing on revenue and just look at saying, oh, keep cutting, then those are going to be the impacts on business on the southern Kenai Peninsula. State parks will be the probably the second one that'll go away. You know, I mean, they'll just not be any more rangers. There won't be any toilets between here and Anchorage, public toilets along the road. All of those things are funded through state government. Employees pay nothing. I was struck by the words that, you know, Alaska survived before oil. We had income tax of 16% of your federal tax before we had oil. So, you know, when you look at those things, you got to look at the whole part of it. And I think that we are hoping to maintain where we are, but we're only going to be able to do that if we wake up and make sure that we're not robbing our savings and burning burning the rafters, as the governor said, to heat the home.
All right, thank you, Paul. John? Welcome.
Is that for me?
Thank you. For me. Representative, what would you do as a representative to attract new business to the southern Kenai Peninsula?
One of the things you have to understand is we want to entice businesses to come to the state of Alaska. So one way to do that is to give individuals tax credits. Now, and I'm not saying for the whole life of the business. Now, anybody that's been in the business knows that a business will survive or fail within the first 5 years. If they make it past that first 5 years, they will survive. At that point is when you cut off giving them tax credits, as we do like the oil companies. All right. The other thing is we need to open our minds and accept new concepts like the hemp industry. It is an industry that will provide thousands of jobs and sources of revenue for the state. It's that simple. We have to get away from our high horse and open up.
Thank you, John. So that actually swerved right into our next question. If you want to keep the microphone, John, we'll direct this at you. And it's a combination of questions. And so given the constraints of time, which is always fun to say when you're given the authority to say it, we'll just merge these two questions, and it also fits with where the chamber's head is at. So what role does the state play in helping reduce the harmful impacts of opioids and heroin abuse in Alaska? And then how does the implementation of legalized marijuana play into that, or does it?
Okay, it does not. Now, the first problem we have with opiates is that the state prescribes these things to our people. It's amazing. It's just amazing that they have a bigger problem with kids ODing with meds that are coming out of their parents' cabinets as opposed to the legalization of marijuana. Okay, a lot of times you'll hear that marijuana is a gateway drug. Everything that we consume today is a gateway drug. Sugar, bacon, it's a gateway. Anytime we abuse something, it is considered a gateway. No, as far as opiates, what we need to do is those individuals that are suffering from heroin addiction, which we do have a big problem here on the Kenai Peninsula, we don't need to put those individuals in jail. We need to take funding and put them in a rehab facility. Let's help them. Let's not penalize them. Because what I have found in my past and with individuals that I have counseled, once they go to a penitentiary or some type of lockup facility, when they come out of there, they're even worse than before. They've picked up some kind of other bad habit.
Good. Thank you, John. Paul, to you, what role does the state have in helping reduce the harmful impacts of opioid and heroin abuse in Alaska, and how does the legalization and implementation of the new law to legalize marijuana play into that, if at all?
Well, first of all, on opioids, I am the House member that was appointed to the opioid task force. Every 2 weeks there's a meeting across state, and Senator Sullivan just had a task force meeting up in Wasilla, trying to bring federal government in here as well. SB 74 that we passed had provisions in there that set up a task force to look at this. I introduced a bill, House Bill 344, in the House. I don't think we needed the task force. I think we needed to hop on and start some changes in prescription drug standards of what we're doing. The CDC, it has a recommendation for that acute pain should only be treated with 3 days as an initial prescription. And what we have is docs that are given 30-day initial prescriptions. That's bad to have in your cabinets. If you're giving them to people and they're trained to follow the doctor's instructions, they're almost addicted by the time they get through with that initial month taking those. So we had a provision in there that limited the initial prescription to 7 days unless their doctor wrote on the script that there was actually a necessity for a longer prescription, something like somebody in rural Alaska or going on a vessel wouldn't be able to get back and then they could do more. But we need to limit the gateway is our medical community. All of our physicians were trained to treat pain aggressively, and they have treated pain aggressively, and we have this huge opioid drug abuse problem. More people die in Alaska because of prescription pain meds than they do from heroin. But the conversion to heroin is because heroin's cheaper than prescription pain meds. So we've got a prescription drug database that's in there. We made that much more active in this last legislature. We put in that the doctors have to check it before they make the prescription, because you have people out getting prescriptions from many places, as well as the dispensers, the pharmacists have to write in on the database, and they have to do that at least daily so that we get the data in there that doctors can check and find out if people are really addicted to drugs and are prescribing them for some reason. So that's the way we're looking at this and trying to get there. And marijuana, I don't think, has anything to do with our prescription drug problem that's been created by the medical community.
Okay, thank you, Paul.
Thanks. At the local level, what we have been doing to combat this, we have a group of organizations in the city of Homer very proactive in trying to address this. So the council has engaged with them in what we consider a strategic doing process, and it's a short loop. You meet and you go away for 2 months and you do whatever the next step is, and you come back, you meet, and you figure out what you can do next. And what they have been successful in doing is putting in place a needle exchange. What a needle exchange does is it doesn't eliminate the addiction, it just eliminates some of the ancillary hepatitis and HIV transmission and some of the ancillary exposures that come with this addictive behavior in our communities. I think that that the state role at this point needs to be maybe not as much focused. I mean, certainly if there's money that can be made available through the system for medical purposes, but maybe helping get out of the way. Sometimes legislation and regulation gets in the way of actually being able to address the problem. And I know that there are a couple of regulations that prohibit or preclude people from being able to provide treatment for people that have overdosed. So there are restrictions on overdose treatment care. And that's not necessarily helping the situation, because we need to help. I mean, these people are addicted and we need to help them. And it was really interesting. We had a professor come in and do a presentation in conjunction with all of this activity going on recently in the community. And he said something that I found very interesting. We think of people as addicts as bad people. A lot of people that are addicted to opioids came by that in a way that was not a bad thing. It's just they don't have a path for exiting from that. So as we've gone through this process, things that I'm starting, for me it's a listen and learn process, but things that I figured out that we have learned, marijuana has been, it's on our plate, we talk about it all the time. One of the things with marijuana is it really helps people with opioid addictions to get off of opioids. That doesn't require the legalization of marijuana in the recreational use sense. You can have prescription marijuana laws that allow people to use marijuana as a viable alternative to help them recover from opioid addiction. So those are the kinds of regulations and laws. We need to be looking at the big picture. And we get caught up in the semantics and the rhetoric and all those things and forget to really look at what the benefits are in the big picture. So I think that's what the state needs to do sometimes. Just get out of the way and don't create havoc where you don't need to.
Okay, thank you very much, Ben. Hey, great questions from the audience. Thank you. And I believe those are going to be made available to the candidates. And let this not be the end of the conversation. All three are extremely available. I know that because I've interviewed them. I'm not going to say they're available at www.ontopoftheworldradio.com, but I'm not going to. I'm not going to say that, but they're very available, and I think we should all avail ourselves to them and let this conversation continue. Meanwhile, we will at this time begin, as the clock dictates, with the closing statements, and we'll do that in the order with which we started, which would take it down the table to Mr. Cox. You have two and two. You're like Chuck Woolery. Two minutes. John, take it away.
Once again, I want to thank everybody for showing up, and it's been real important that you come to listen to what we have to say. You know, I didn't mention this earlier with the opiates, right? Marijuana has been an item that has saved my wife's life, right?
That's me. I'm not dead. Why so? But you won't mention, and I wish you wouldn't give away his time because I would like to say I'm also an alcoholic. I have an opiate addiction. I already kicked Kristen up because I don't like it because it's not a gateway drug for me. I can explain all this. I beg you to let me keep my marijuana because it's the only thing I have left and I will never die on it. And I can prove that. The government has proved it. I will do anything. Please, please let me speak with you. Even if you hate me right now for what I am because it's a disease. And when I fall back, it's relapse. When anyone with cancer doesn't make it, isn't it remission?
Okay.
Sorry, thank you.
Thanks.
Yay!
It's important that we look at this to say, you know, we lose a veteran once every 26 minutes, and it's a shame. We need to make this herb available to our soldiers and sailors, right? And like to my wife. I just can't overemphasize how important it is, why we prescribe opiates to our veterans and everybody else. If you read the labels, they actually annotate in there that it will cause dependencies and suicidal thoughts. So why do we do this to our veterans that are suffering from PTSD? You know, I'm just asking you for your help. One thing that people have learned, that I do not know how to stop fighting, and I will always continue fighting for you. You know, this country has entrusted me with the lives of your family, friends, brothers, sisters, and I've never lost a life on my watch. And I'm asking you to trust me once again with the state of Alaska.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, and I appreciate everybody being here tonight. And I again want to remind you that I'm a person that has worked on solutions, that's my orientation. That's what I do for you in the legislature. I look for solutions. I also send out, whether you're in real estate or any of the other business communities, when regulations are coming up, I send out an email to notice you, to comment on those regulations before they become effect, and we can help as well as you know that I do. When you let me know, then I make sure that the appropriate folks are knowing that those regulations are problematic. I would like to take a moment to say, you know, when people want to put off revenue, once you enact it, it takes a year and a half at least to get that revenue in place. So if we're talking about not doing anything till the end of the next legislature or two legislatures, what we're talking about is being broke before we can ever start collecting anything. You know, a statement was that we should wait for the people of Alaska to speak. People of this district have spoken. You know, on my website, if you go to fiscal plan and go down to the bottom, you'll find the survey that 300 people in our district and two town hall meetings came back for and answered. You can look at all those answers. They said, we like the services we get in Alaska, and we want to maintain those services with a tax. And so anyway, I just want to say that some of the ideas that we have, value of jobs are nice, but they're not nice as far as to the state treasury. The state treasury currently gets no tax revenue from a job at all. Only expense by providing infrastructure to that. So I ask you again to keep a driver in Juneau, vote for Paul Seaton on Tuesday. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I also want to thank you for coming out, and I will reiterate, as I did at the last meeting, this is an election that will be determined at the primary. So it's really imperative that you vote either between now and the 15th, or you get out and vote on the 16th if you're interested in voting on this issue. In order to vote on this issue, you have to be able to cast a Republican ballot, which means you are a registered Republican, undeclared or nonpartisan, and you request the Republican ballot when you are signing in to vote. So I'd like to encourage everyone to be sure to get out and vote, and a vote for Beth Wyeth will be a vote for continued and consistent conservative values in Juneau. Representative Seaton throws out regularly doing nothing, and I don't believe that either of us said do nothing. We have done nothing for 2 years. We have done nothing for 4 years. The issue that's before the state of Alaska didn't just occur in the recent legislation or the recent legislative period. It has been known since the first time that we had a substantial reduction in oil and gas revenue that we needed to find alternatives to oil and gas revenues, and we have not done that. We have spent hundreds of millions of dollars continuing to do projects that were oil and gas related, which is good because we need to get that gas off the slope. But we have done absolutely nothing to diversify our economy in that time frame, in any recent time frame. And that's, we're talking back to like the 80s and then again in the 90s. So I would like to see a change happen down in Juneau. I would like to see us look at new alternatives. You know, kind of raise your eyes off the horizon and see what the big picture is out there instead of focusing continually on the same drum all the time. Thank you so much again for coming out. We appreciate your time and efforts.
Thank you very much, Beth. Let's get one more big round for John Cox, Paul Seaton, and Beth White. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Homer Chamber of Commerce's District 31 Candidate Forum. The participants were Representative Paul Seaton of Homer, Homer Mayor Beth Wyeth, and John Cox of Anchor Point. The forum was recorded by Casey Marsh, edited and produced for broadcast by Terry Renssel. Thanks to the Homer Chamber of Commerce for allowing KBBI to record the forum for broadcast. This is KBBI AM 890 Homer.